slamming home, I dove behind the barricade and flattened myself against the floor as the first round splintered through the wood of the upturned edge of the sideboard. Less than 2 seconds later, the next round caromed off the door facing and dug into the floor just short of my outstretched right hand. I was attempting to scramble toward the stairway when Vic leaned out from the railing and snapped off 2 12-gauge rounds into the ceiling, the salvo allowing me a rather ignoble retreat. I ran into Vic, and we both fell down the remaining steps. I was lucky enough to have landed on the bottom. She was sprawled across my chest. We looked at each other, and she grinned.
That was close.
We stayed like that for a moment. Then she rolled off me, and I slid against the wall. We were sitting there on the landing a full 10 seconds before we saw Omar. He was standing in the foyer, eating a ham and cheese sandwich and drinking a bottle of beer.
What the hell?
He lowered the long-neck bottle and cocked his head.
What are you guys doing? You could get killed up there.
He started up the steps, and I noticed he had a .44 hunting sidearm in a holster at his leg.
I brought you guys a beer.
We continued to look at him.
If you want a sandwich, the stuff's still out.
He took another sip, and I thought about throwing him over the railing. He motioned for Vic to take the bottles, which she did after shuttling the shotgun under her arm.
What's the story?
He rolled his eyes and pushed his 50X silver belly hat back from his forehead, the long curls of gold reaching the collar of his white dress shirt.
She started drinking this morning after we had a little talk.
He took another bite of his sandwich. I have to admit it was looking pretty good.
She said she had traded me in on 220-year-olds, and I told her she wasn't wired for 220.
The conversation kind of deteriorated from there. He finished off the beer and threw the bottle so that it shattered against the hand-patterned drywall. He put his hand to the side of his mouth to direct the volume.
Bitch!
2 more .308s slammed through the door above. Vic and I simultaneously ducked as the rounds sped harmlessly down the empty hallway above us. Omar took both of the beers from Vic, opened them on his belt buckle, handed her one back, and took a swig from the other as the cap fell to the carpeted landing and rolled down the stairs.
You didn't by chance happen to count how many holes were in the door?
He continued to look after the bottle cap.
There's only one box of shells for that thing, 16 in a box.
I knew that there was an abundance of weapons in the Rhodes household. What about all the other guns in the safe?
No ammunition. I moved it all downstairs.
They both took sips and looked at me. 12. I nodded back to the landing. And 2 more makes 14. Omar nodded.
She's got 2 left.
We all nodded, as he casually drew the big .44 from his holster, aimed it straight up, and fired 2 shots. The long-barreled Smith & Wesson bucked in his hand. A few pieces of the entryway, elk horn chandelier, and plaster ceiling fell down on us.
Cunt!
The .308 thundered in response, but this time only once. Omar took another swallow.
Wisen up, conserving ammo.
I looked at Vic, who looked at Omar. Any chance of talking to her? Omar laughed, and I looked at him.
Is there a phone in the bedroom?
Yeah.
We traipsed down to the entryway table, where an old-fashioned Belgian dial phone sat. Omar picked up the receiver, dialed the number for the bedroom, and handed the phone to me.
She's not going to talk to me.
The phone rang 3 times before Myra answered.
Bastard!
Myra, it's Walter. She slammed the receiver down with an ear-shattering crack. I asked Omar to dial the number again. She didn't answer this time. But the thunderous report of the .308 and the brief squall and whine of the line informed us that Myra had shot the bedroom phone. I hung up and looked at the two of them. Vic looked back at the landing.
She's out?
Omar agreed.
Yeah.
I wasn't convinced. How drunk is she?
Pretty damn. But she hasn't missed the door yet.
I crossed the landing, staying to the right, where I knew I could dive into the guest bedroom if she had ammunition left after all. The problem was that the closed door seemed a very dangerous 20 feet away. Credit the carpenters that built the Rhodes mansion, the floor didn't creak as I carefully made my way around the barricade. I had holstered my .45. I had no intention of shooting Myra. With the volume of the music, it was impossible to hear any movement in the bedroom. As Edith Piaf continued singing, I looked at what the 150 grain soft points had done to 3 inches of solid wood, and felt that familiar weightlessness in the trunk of my body. I counted the holes in the door again, but the damage caused by the large-caliber rifle made it difficult to be sure how many shots had really been fired. I wasn't betting the farm. It did look as if the shot closest to the knob had taken most of the mechanism with it, and the door itself stood ajar about a quarter of an inch. So I opted for nudging the base of it with my boot. It opened 4 inches. I waited, but nothing happened. I nudged further, gently sweeping it back about halfway, before my leverage gave out. I took a deep breath to clear my head, and stepped through the doorway into the outstretched barrel of the big 308. She'd been waiting, but my left arm was still to my right, so with a sweeping gesture I carried the barrel down and away from me in a backhanded pull that exploded around into the floor. The sound in the room was just short of deafening. I was going to kill Omar. I made a grab for the front stock, but missed as she stepped back and the seemingly endless length of the bolt action swung up. I had forgotten how good-looking Myra was, and the year-long sabbatical in France, with close to $48 million, had done her no harm. She had long blonde hair, the kind you see on the covers of magazines, and perfectly tanned skin that I'm sure had been kissed by the French Riviera. She was wearing a pink mohair cowl-neck sweater that barely reached the top of her thighs, and that was all. She was tall and lean, with strong, capable hands. The honking diamond that Omar had married her with was still on the left hand that pointed the rifle at my face. Above the scope was the palest blue eye, and as my lungs froze, the barrel dipped a little, and the sweater-matching pink lips smiled as slowly as glacial encroachment. I listened to Piaf singing Le Chevalier de Paris or Mon Légionnaire, I wasn't sure which, and thought about how this wasn't the worst way to go. The powder blue blinked, and I settled on Le Chevalier de Paris, as the little bird trilled and softly breathed out her lovingly aching words. Myra sagged a little, almost as if someone had punched her, and tossed the rifle aside. She stepped forward, her arms outstretched around my neck as the sharp fragrance of raspberry vodka scoured the inside of my nose, and her sweater bottom rose higher.
Walter!
Good thing she likes you. He brought his queen out. It was a second game, and my plans for an early evening had gone the way of my 3 pawns, 2 rooks, and a knight. I went with the other knight and felt a shadow of impending doom as his bishop slithered along diagonally. The stem of his pipe swung around and pointed at me like the barrel of a gun, the second of the evening.
"You get her out of the house?"
The pipe returned to his mouth. I leaned back in the horsehide wing-back chair and placed my hat on my knee. The old sheriff wasn't ready to end the evening and skimmed the other bishop across the board for a completely different attack on my king. She's at the end of the trail motel over in Sheridan. Flies out tomorrow. It was quiet in the room as the old sheriff looked at me. Lucian's mahogany eyes flickered in the half-light of the kitchenette behind us. He shook his head.
"Well, you know how my marriage experience ended."
I did, and we sat there in silence for a while before I admitted a prejudice. "I hate the domestic stuff." He nodded and watched me.
"Like the third man in a hockey fight, you get the blame and get the shit kicked out of you for your troubles."
He waited as I made another inane move.
"I hear Kyle Straub's got signs up all over town."
I took a sip and crunched one of the cubes. "I heard that, too."
"You gonna stand?"
"I don't think I've got any choice if I want to get Vic in." He shrugged.
"I'd vote for her, but I've got the weakness."
Lucian was referring to his habit of addressing Vic's chest as if it had an identity of its own.
"The rest of Absaroka County is another question. Now, you can make sure she's the next sheriff, but it's gonna cost you a year or two of your life."
I made a face.
But then I didn't know your life in office was so damn bad.
His gaze dropped back to the board.
Check.
I looked at the assembly of courtly pieces and placed a finger on my king, casually toppling him over to premature death.
Yep, well, no act of kindness goes unpunished.
Chapter 2. It took 5 days to get the three of us to Philadelphia. He didn't let me drive. He drove only during daylight hours, and he went 55 the whole way. I read the AAA books as we drove across the country, even though I had an inkling that the Cheyenne Nation had not appreciated my oratory since Iowa. And I decided that the majority of the United States consists of gently rolling hills with light industry. I was still reading as we loped across the Schuylkill Expressway with the top down, eased off the 15th Street exit, took a left on Race, and a stately right on Broad. It was a gentleman's agreement in 1894 that no skyscraper built would be taller than Penn's Hat, but in 1986 all bets had been called off, and now the majority of the fifth largest city in the country looks down on Billy Penn and City Hall. Henry carefully parked the big convertible in front of a high Victorian Gothic building and cut the engine.
You can stop reading now. We have arrived.
I've still got the Philadelphia section to... He gave me a dirty look. We figured we had best check in at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts, since they were expecting the bear a day earlier. I unclipped my seatbelt, tossed the guide into the cavernous back seat, and scratched behind Dog's ear. I hope you're not in trouble. His expression didn't change as he pulled the handle and swung the 4-foot door onto Greater Broad Street, causing a taxi to swerve and blare its horn. He stepped out of Lola and stood, stretching his back and flipping his ponytail over his shoulder. He pulled a half-beaded, fully fringed leather jacket from behind the seat and slipped it on, instantly going native.
I am never in trouble.
I watched as the cars continued to swerve around him.
Thinking you're not in trouble and not being in trouble are two different things.
His face remained immobile as he shut the door and walked back against the traffic.
No, they are not.
Dog immediately jumped into the driver's seat, another gentleman's agreement broken, and we both watched as the big Indian casually crossed the sidewalk, passed the federal-style lampposts, mounted the steps, and disappeared behind the dark oak doors. People who were walking by stared at Henry, then at Lola, Dog, and me. I waved, but they didn't wave back. So much for the city of brotherly love. I looked south, then west, to Market, and then up 32 imaginary floors to where the next in-from-the-corner window of a particularly dark, glass-clad building would be, if not for the building in front of it. I had asked Katie why she hadn't gotten the corner office, to which she had replied, "I will." I glanced back to the courthouse clock, 6:20. She'd still be at work. She never got home until at least 8. I looked around for Henry's cell phone, finally locating it at the end of the power cord under Dog's appropriated seat. I wasn't very good with the things, but I pushed one of the little buttons that had a tiny phone image on it, was rewarded with a chirp and an illuminated display of the Bighorn Mountains, and was immediately homesick. I got over it and selected contacts, working my way through about 20 women's names just to get to the C's. I scrolled down to Katie/work, and pushed the phone button again. It rang only once.
"Hello, Bear. Are you finally here?"
Evidently I was in trouble. If you could look out your window up Broad Street, you would see a powder blue convertible with a seasoned yet ruggedly handsome sheriff and his trusty companion, Dog. There was a pause.
"You brought the dog?"
Evidently I was in a lot of trouble. "Is that a problem?" Another pause. This one, no shorter than the last.
"Devin's allergic to dogs."
I looked over at my buddy, who looked back at me with his big brown eyes. "You have hurt Dog's feelings."
"Daddy!"
I reached over and scratched under his chin, which was his favorite spot. "Well, I can see if Henry can take him."
There was even another pause, and I started getting a little miffed. We wouldn't want to inconvenience Devon. Dad! It was a short word, but it had a lot behind it. I watched as an elegant woman of about 30 rushed across the sidewalk and quickly made her way up the stairs, her charcoal trench coat billowing after her. She wore heels and had very nice legs. A set of keys hung from a lanyard in her hand, along with a collection of IDs, probably something to do with Henry. I was still looking after her when a black basket-weave Sam Brown belt with a Glock 19 blocked my view. I looked up at a young blonde policewoman with a name tag that read Officer Sharp and spoke into the phone. "Let me call you back." "Dad, wait a—" I pushed the red button and the tiny phone chirped again. Dog growled, and I hushed him with a quick glance. I tipped my head back to look at myself in the cop's sunglasses. She gestured with her pen, which was already out. "He didn't drive the whole way, did he?" I tossed the cell phone onto the center console and smiled. "No, we switched off in Cleveland." She didn't smile back. "You need to move the vehicle." I looked over the steering column at the empty switch. I'd never seen Henry Standing Bear take the keys out of anything in 30 years. I glanced back up. "I don't have the keys." "That's okay, I'll get it moved for you." She snapped the button on her two-way and held it toward her mouth. "Unit 43, 1092 at the corner of Cherry and Broad." She paused. "Roger that, 1051. I need a hook."
I thought of my luggage, of Henry's, and of the Northern Cheyenne photographic find of the century that was in 3 hat boxes in the trunk. "Patrolman Sharp, I think my friend just ran inside to find out where we could unload some things." She smiled for the first time, maybe because I noticed her name and rank or not.
"That's okay. We'll let you get your stuff out before we take the car. I'll even let you keep the dog."
She was talking into the mic again.
"Long as you got a leash for him."
I thought about all the things Dog didn't have, including a leash, as the cell phone began ringing. "Can't you just write a ticket?" She pulled out her docket and flipped it open.
"I'm going to do that, too."
I picked up the phone and read Katie's work number.
"Make it an expensive one, will you?"
I pushed the talk button again. "Hello?
Did you just hang up on me?"
I was distracted by a movement to the officer's side. The woman I had seen disappear up the stairs was back.
"Hi, Kathy."
Officer Sharp lowered her pen as she half-turned.
"Michelle?"
I looked up at the window on Market, and I swear I could feel Katie looking down on me.
"I didn't hang up on you."
The woman indicated the car in which I was sitting.
"This is one of ours."
The officer sighed.
"Is it moving soon?"
The voice on the cell phone was insistent.
"Are you still there?"
I tried to speak quietly.
"I've got a little situation here."
Michelle nodded and stepped back to trail an arm toward Henry, who was now standing at her side.
"This is Henry Standing Bear. He's here in conjunction with the Museum of the American Indian and the Smithsonian to—" "Look, Dad, I've got to work late tonight, so you're on your own. I probably won't make it home till after 10, all right?"
It wasn't a question. "All right."
"You remember where I told you I hide the key?"
"Yep."
"You and the bear can find the place?"
I nodded at the phone, like I always do when I'm trying to get it to like me. "I think so."
"See if Henry can take the dog, please. Devon is deathly allergic."
I stared at the receiver for a while.
"Dad?"
It was quiet on the phone.
"It's been a long day, and it looks like it's going to get longer."
I nodded some more. "Anything I can do, like bring you dinner?"
"No, Patty went out already." "Dad,"
the irritation was returning to her voice,
"that Moretti woman called twice to set up lunch with us. I spoke with her earlier today when I thought you were going to be here, and she wanted to stop by tonight."
The irritation was now back in full.
"Do you know why this has suddenly become so important to this woman? I mean, I've been here for a while."
I remembered the conversation on the jail steps. Vic said something about how her mother was feeling guilty about not getting in touch with you.
Well, if you would, her number is on the notepad by the phone at my place. Can you call and set something up with her for some other time? Tonight just isn't good.
I'm getting that. The longest silence since I hadn't hung up on her. By the time I'd closed the phone and rejoined the outside world, Dog had jumped into the back, Henry was fastening his seatbelt, and the women were gone. He watched my face.
Trouble?
Always. I studied the windshield. Where were we headed? He watched me for a moment longer and then slipped the big bird into gear.
I can drop you off, then come back here and unload the stuff.
You want to get something to eat? He cleared his throat very quietly.
I think I have a date.
I had to smile and shake my head. Already? His turn to look out the windshield.
The corner of Quarry and Bread, over in Old City?
I thought about how there were more than 9 times as many people in Philadelphia than there were in the entire state of Wyoming, and how it seemed that none of them wanted to have dinner with me. We circled around City Hall and headed east on Market. I wanted to reconnoiter a little before being left on foot. I'd never been to Philadelphia before and was planning on spending the next day as a tourist, so we took a brief detour around Independence Square, taking in Independence Hall and the Liberty Bell Center and Pavilion. There were more trees on this side of town, and I was comforted by the park rangers in their dark green uniforms and Smokey the Bear lids. At least I wouldn't be the only one in town wearing a cowboy hat. "Where have they got you staying?" He shrugged, checked the rearview mirror, and took a right on Race between the National Constitution Center and the Mint. I could see why Katie had chosen this part of town, with its narrow tree-lined streets, its access to the Delaware River, and the overarching view of the Benjamin Franklin Bridge. It felt like a neighborhood. I guess it had always been one. The AAA book said that old Ben was buried here, at Christ Church. A year ago, when Katie had bought her building with the trust money bequeathed to her by her maternal grandmother, Old City had again been an up-and-coming area. As I looked around at the boutiques, coffee shops, and trendy bars, it looked like Old City had arrived. Henry slowed the convertible and waited for the traffic to move so that we could turn at Bread Street and Paddy O'Neill's Tavern, a little Irish bar on the corner that Katie had told me about. She went almost every Saturday night to hear the live music and stayed until the musicians were subdued by the local Yuengling beer. Katie always brought me a six-pack of the long necks in her carry-on. I looked at the blue and gold lights of Ben's bridge shooting into the darkness, the suspension cables only half-lit in the fading umber of twilight. The stacked stone buttresses looked like castled pavilions along the Delaware River, with the arch lights illuminating the stone with a yellowish-green tint. I could hear the clatter of the light rail banging along on the tracks below the bridge's walking paths. Katie didn't have a car, and generally walked the 32 blocks back and forth to work. I wondered if she ever had the time to see this picture-postcard view of her neighborhood. I worried about her walking home at night, but I worried about her brushing her teeth and breathing. Like most parents, I just worried.
You can drink your dinner.
It sounded appealing. They probably had food, and it was within easy crawling distance of home. I glanced in the windows of the bars we passed. It was a Thursday night, which meant I wouldn't be assaulted by live music or a crowd. I'd just pay for the privilege of my own company. I'd seen pictures of the little tannery building she had bought, and there it was, a strangely squat, 1.5-story commercial-looking structure with a forged iron atrium. The large carriage opening was still there along the street, but there was also a side entrance with a covered entryway. The bear eased the car to a stop along the curb. The only light was on the corner, about 50 feet and another building down. We sat there for a moment, and I broached the subject of Dog.
If it's going to be too big of a pain in the ass, just say so. It is going to be too big of a pain in the ass.
I nodded, and we got out and retrieved my bags from the trunk. I wheeled everything across the cobblestones to the door. Breakfast?
How about lunch?
I nodded and shook my head as he climbed in and started the T-Bird. Leave it to Henry to have already arranged a tryst. Dog. The big brute had been waiting for the word and lithely slipped over the side of the car. He joined me on the sidewalk as we watched the twin turbines' brake lights disappear down the cobblestone street. I scratched his bulky head and he looked up at me. Piss on the bunch of them, huh? He wagged in response. Two orphans in a town without pity. The key didn't work. I tried it the way she said. I jiggled it and struggled to get it to turn in the other direction, but no go. I walked back to the carriage entrance and tried moving these doors, but they didn't budge. I thought about abandoning my bags and heading for O'Neill's, but I wasn't sure how they'd receive Dog, and we were in it together. There was a narrow walkway of broken flagstone and weeds to my right, so I decided to see what the back of the building held in way of ingress. I stuffed my suitcases in the entryway in hopes that they would still be there when I got back, picked up the sidearm case, patted my leg for Dog to follow, and turned sideways for the two-step between the brick walls. The brim of my hat proved to be cumbersome, so I removed it and held it in the hand with the small locked case. The wall behind me was solid, but Katie's building had windows set high, about 6 feet up, and I could see the suspended walkways that made up the mezzanine. Dog was looking as well, and cocking his head at what might have been singing. I was almost to the end of the path when I fully heard it. It was La Donna Immobile from Verdi's Rigoletto, sotto voce and melodic without trying, but there was no instrumental accompaniment. I couldn't help but wonder where you would get such a recording. I thought the sound might be coming from the building behind me, but when I got to the end and a chain-link fence, I realized it was coming from Katie's overgrown terrace. If Verdi had been with me, he would have folded his arms across the top of the gate, placed his chin on his arms, and gazed at what I'm sure he would have perceived as the Gilda of his dreams. At the center of the patio, in the perfect light of dusk, I could make out a fine-featured, dark-haired woman seated at a round bistro table, her legs stretched out before her and crossed at the ankles, with one elbow resting on the table's pockmarked surface. She wore black capri pants and a stylish white blouse open at the throat. One arm was relaxed over the iron chair, and the other was holding a short-stemmed wine glass, to which she sang like a child. Woman is fickle, indeed. It's a tenor part for the Duke. But she sang it effortlessly with a husky soprano that would have had Verdi rethinking his libretto, if not his libido. She paused at one of the breaks in the music and, with perfect timing, raised the wine glass to her lips. Even from this distance, I could see the hint of ginger in her almond-shaped eyes. I slipped my hat back on for identification purposes, and softly applauded as her face turned toward me. "Brava! Bellissima! Bella! Bella!" She saluted ever so slightly with her glass, and downed the wine in one smooth swig like a longshoreman.
"Howdy, Sheriff!"
She opened the door without any problem. I dropped my bags, and we reoccupied the small terrace. Lena Moretti had raided the pantries of a dozen specialty shops in the Italian market, and we were currently munching on small slices of stiff bread, prosciutto, mozzarella, and basil, all of which had been smothered in olive oil, first pressed. We were about to finish the bottle of Chianti.